Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Pope on Prayer, Liturgy and the Second Vatican Council. We report on Pope Benedict's catechesis at his Wednesday General Audience, where he looks at the liturgy as another source of prayer. Syrian conflict, children are paying the highest price. We hear from the Holy See's permanent observer to the UN and the charity Save the Children about the appalling plight of Syria's children. And US Archbishop says marriage is undermined and under threat. We speak to the Archbishop of Newark, who has just released a pastoral letter on marriage. At his Wednesday General Audience, Pope Benedict looked at the liturgy as a source of prayer and noted how the Second Vatican Council rightly began its work by discussing the liturgy. Emma McCarthy tells us more.
Overcast autumnal skies threatened rain this Wednesday, but failed to dampen the spirits of the thousands of pilgrims and curious tourists who filled St. Peter's as Pope Benedict XVI emerged to tour the square in his iconic Popemobile. The Pope was flown to Rome by helicopter from his summer retreat in Castel Gandolfo, one of his last commutes as his period in the Alban Hills draws to a close at the end of the month. The Pope officially returns to the Vatican in October, which promises to be a busy month for the Holy Father with the upcoming Synod of Bishops and the launching of the Year of Faith. But ahead of this, Pope Benedict also launched a new cycle of catechesis in his Wednesday meeting with believers on how God himself teaches us to pray in the liturgy.
The word liturgy in Greek means work done by the people and for the people. Here this people is a new people of God, brought into being by Christ, a people which does not exist by itself and which is not bound by blood, territory or country, but is brought into being through the Paschal mystery.
In his comments in Italian, the Pope said that in order to celebrate the liturgy well, to really experience the reenactment of Christ's Paschal mystery, we must understand that it is the action of God and of man, as the Second Vatican Council teaches us.
The Council began its work by discussing the liturgy, and rightly so, for the liturgy reminds us of the primacy of God. The fundamental criterion for it is its orientation towards the Father, whose saving love culminates in the death and the resurrection of his Son.
Concluding his appointment with the estimated 20,000 people present in the square, Pope Benedict greeted pilgrims in various languages, reminding them, Altare Dei est cor nostrum, our hearts are God's altar, and must always be directed towards him. I'm Emer McCarthy.
I want all of you and your God's blessings of joy and peace.
Pope Benedict has spoken of his grief at seeing the terrible suffering and loss of life endured by children during the current conflict in Syria. The Holy See's permanent observer to the UN has urged the international community to make Syria's children a priority when delivering humanitarian aid to the victims of the war. And this week, the charity Save the Children issued a chilling report saying that children in Syria are subjected to appalling torture, imprisonment and abduction. The message is coming across loud and clear from many different sources that Syria's children, as the youngest and most vulnerable and voiceless members of the population, are suffering badly as the nation's civil war continues to intensify. Archbishop Silvano Tomasi is the Holy See's permanent observer to the UN in Geneva, and he told me that he has no doubt that children in Syria are paying the heaviest price in this conflict.
I think we should place in the context of the crisis in Syria what is happening to the children of that country. The crisis is worsening because more violence is documented, and among the victims, both of people killed or tortured or forced to seek a refuge in the neighboring countries like Jordan, Turkey, Iraq, and Lebanon, there are many, many children. In some camps, half of the population is made up of children. There are hundreds of unaccompanied minors who are also present in some of the camps. There are abundant signs that some children have been used as human shields to protect soldiers or rebels in their effort to advance toward their military objectives. So I think the fact that children are paying the highest price in this conflict and families are disrupted should alert the conscience of the international community not only to work harder to find a negotiated solution to stop the violence, but also to trying to find ways and means to help the mental health, the traumatized situation of the many children of Syria.
But how hopeful are you that anything can be done to alleviate this plight of the children, given, as you said, that the scale of the fighting in the Syrian civil war seems to be getting worse each week?
The international community is talking about finding a path to peace and to stop the violence. But obviously, there are deep political divisions, and so the Security Council is unable to reach a common conclusion, an acceptable conclusion. And the same applies in other fora like the Council for Human Rights here in Geneva, where there is the will on the part of everyone to advance the cause of peace and to find a practical way to stop violence. But de facto, nothing serious is moving because arms are still introduced into Syria to support both sides of the fight. There is divided political interest to support one or the other faction. There is lack of unity in the group, in the various groups actually, who are contesting the legitimacy of the government in Syria. And so at this point in time, there is not much hope for an immediate ceasefire. But this should not dispense the international community from renewing its effort, as the Secretary General of the United Nations has rightly pointed out in his opening speech of the General Assembly, and as other people of goodwill are saying, beginning with our Holy Father.
Archbishop Tamazi also spoke of his fears that the Syrian conflict could spread to other countries in the region.
You mentioned that the media can help by reporting on the situation in Syria with fairness and complete information, so that, as you said, public opinion may more easily grasp the futility of war. Do you think that sometimes this conflict in Syria is reported by the international media in a way that implies that there was no other alternative to the taking up of arms, that this conflict was inevitable?
Experience shows us that violence never pays off. The futility of violence, the futility of war can be seen in this case in the dramatic evidence of the facts. We have already, since the conflict started in March 2011, between 20 and 30,000 dead, 260,000, maybe 280,000 refugees in the various bordering countries, 1,200,000 estimated internally displaced people. And according to the aid agencies that have a hard time to deliver assistance, some 2.5 million Syrians are in serious need of humanitarian assistance. So if we look at this reality, then I think we need to really make an effort to sit around the table and find a way to stop the violence, because otherwise the situation will not only worsen, but will be contagious in spreading this conflict to other areas, to other countries in the region, and it might even become a danger and a risk for international peace. So the goodwill of the countries of the world, especially the more powerful countries, needs to be reaffirmed and to make a renewed effort to find an end to this violence.
You mentioned earlier the supply of arms to both sides, and Pope Benedict, of course, appealed for an end to this supply of arms during his recent pastoral visit to Lebanon. But as we know, many countries outside Syria are supplying arms, both to the Syrian regime and to the armed opposition. How much do you believe that this outside support helps to prolong the duration of the conflict?
I think we have to make a careful distinction in this discussion. One is the need to advance a more democratic and participatory form of management of the state in Syria, where all the minorities that make up this country, from the Kurds to the Christians to the Alawi to the Sunni, Shia, Druze, everybody should have equal right to participate, and so to affirm the value of citizenship as a criteria for political involvement and not other consideration. Then, with citizenship accepted, the freedom for each individual and each group to function should also be guaranteed, of course, according to international standards. So it's not a question of saying that everything is working out well and that there is no need of change. I think from what I'm able to assess, change should come about. But the presence of mercenaries and the inflow of arms is certainly damaging any effort to arrive at some kind of decision to negotiate a solution in the respect of all interested parties.
I was speaking to Archbishop Silvano Tomasi, the Holy See's permanent observer to the United Nations. In a report issued on Tuesday, the charity Save the Children said it had documented numerous cases of abuse against children during Syria's 18-month-old conflict and called for these atrocities to be better documented. The report was based on the testimony of Syrian refugee children who had fled to neighbouring countries and said they told of kids as young as six being tortured and starved. To find out more, I spoke to Hedin Haldorsen, who helped compile the charity's report after speaking to Syrian refugee children in Jordan.
One of the reasons why we are choosing to speak out at this point in time is that we are hearing more and more testimonies. The number of refugees fleeing Syria is growing, and one of our mandates is to speak out on behalf of children. Children are voiceless, they don't have a voice, which is why we gathered their testimonies and chose to go public and publish the report.
Your report talks of numerous cases of abuse against Syrian children. What sort of numbers are we talking about here?
We fear that this is only the tip of the iceberg. We talked to 80 children. We did that in refugee camps in Jordan, and we also had testimonies from Lebanon. A number of them had been tortured. A number had seen massacres. They had seen their loved ones killed. Many had been imprisoned and had witnessed other children being tortured or imprisoned or killed. It is difficult and impossible probably for us to tell or to give you numbers, but as I said, we do fear that this is the tip of the iceberg. The testimonies are consistent, and they are also in line and confirm what other human rights organizations have found and what the UN has found in the past couple of months.
Are both sides in the conflict responsible for these abuses against children?
Save the Children, as an impartial organization, we don't point a finger. We simply point out that children are the innocent victims of the conflict, being responsible for carrying out atrocities against children.
And as far as you know, have any of the perpetrators ever been brought to account?
Not yet. That is basically why we are calling on the UN today. We are all familiar with the gridlock in the Security Council. We are calling on the UN and member states today to document all reports and hold those responsible to account. If that is not done, it will be impossible to hold to account those responsible for the atrocities being carried out.
Your report also mentioned that almost every child you spoke to from Syria has seen a family member killed. That makes the casualties very widespread. Was that in some ways surprising for you?
I've been in Jordan for a month and I've been working in the camp. Personally, the extent of this has surprised us. We did know what we were dealing with because other organizations have been reporting on this in past weeks and months. But yes, the extent of this, I think I have to say, has been bigger and broader than we thought.
And how were most of these family members of these children killed? Were they killed in fighting? Were they killed in bombing raids or what?
These children, what they are telling us, they talk about shelling, they talk about bombing raids, they talk about attacks, houses being shelled, they talk about mosques, hospitals and schools being shelled.
Can you share with us some of the most shocking cases of children tortured that you were able to document, you know, what kind of treatment they had, how they were tortured?
I can tell you the story of a 15-year-old. I spent a day with him and the Save the Children social worker that he has been assigned. He has been in the camp, the Satory refugee camp, for a month. Two of his brothers are in prison in Syria. One of his brothers has been killed. One brother is in hospital here in Jordan because he suffered from second-degree burn wounds when their home was shelled in Syria. And this particular boy, a 15-year-old, he was in prison for 22 days. He eventually got out, as he said with his own words. They used electricity. He was beaten. They poured water in his face, so torture in different methods.
There was another case described with a teenager called Wail, who shared a cell with decomposing bodies. Do you know anything about that case?
That is one of the cases. A colleague of mine, she spoke to a majority of them, and I spoke to a couple. The boy that I'm referring to, he mentioned that as well, that in the cell where he had been imprisoned, there had been decomposing bodies.
What other sort of ways were children being tortured? If you could just sort of describe a little bit the methods being used.
Some children described cigarettes being put out on their skin. Some were tied on their wrists and then hung up to the ceiling. They were beaten, and many of them witnessed other children being tortured and killed.
And how young were some of these children? Were they all sort of well into their teens, or were some of them even younger?
The youngest child that we were told by children that had been tortured was 6 years old, but the age range is pretty broad, probably from 6 till 18.
And what had he done to warrant that?
I don't have an answer to that question. He was that child, according to the child that we got the testimony from, this happened in prison, and that particular child witnessed all the child being tortured.
So presumably these children that you met were highly traumatized by what they'd been through.
They are. These children are severely distressed. So what we are doing, we are basically, if I keep on talking about that particular case, he is meeting with Save the Children social worker every day, and they're talking. He's unaccompanied, that boy. So basically the only focal point, the only grown-up that boy has is our worker. But if you look about the impact and the symptoms of how these children are behaving after having witnessed all that, it differs a lot. You can see aggression. You can see a child behaving in a way that is not normal for its age. Some children end up not interacting with other children. They stop playing. Others become unusually attached to their caretakers, and that is out of fear of losing them. You see aggression as well. You see bedwetting. You can see nightmares. But obviously, this has a huge psychological impact, witnessing violence and witnessing death and destruction.
How does Save the Children see the future for Syria's children, given that the nation seems locked into a deepening civil war? You know, each week it gets worse, it gets more intense.
Children's resilience should probably not be underestimated, because children are incredibly resilient. So if provided with the right protective environment, if they are provided with routine, and that's basically what we're trying to do, to inject some normalcy into their lives, because all they've known in the past 18 months is limited access or no access to schools, limited access to health services. They've lost loved ones, they've seen bombardment, and they've seen death. So we are basically trying to get them back to normal.
Now, how optimistic are you that the release of this report documenting this appalling torture will have any impact, you know, on the two sides involved in this conflict, on public opinion worldwide?
Of course, we do believe that it will have an impact, otherwise we wouldn't have spoken out today. What we think is important is to send a message, and the UN is probably the only power in a position to send out that message that there is no impunity and that those responsible will be held to account. And what Save the Children prioritizes as well, that the mechanisms that are in place to detect and to identify and verify grave child rights violations, that these mechanisms are strengthened. And that is not the case currently. There is a mechanism, but it needs to be strengthened, and the resources need to be mobilized. And this is something that has to come from the UN. Let me just add on that, because that mechanism, it has been triggered. What is needed is simply to document more systematically, and this is something that, since it has been triggered, what now has to happen is for the UN to have a greater presence on the ground, then humanitarian organizations will feed into that documentation as well in order to have proofs and then documentation for the crimes that have been committed.
But presumably in the near to medium term, the suffering of Syria's children is going to go on being caught up in this conflict.
A part of launching this campaign today is, of course, to put pressure and to raise the profile and speaking out on behalf of children. Because as we've seen, there is a gridlock. This is the 18 months that the conflict goes on. Trying children, innocent sufferers, on the agenda and speak out on their behalf. We're trying to push on those who have the power to act.
I was speaking to Hedin Haldorsen of the charity Save the Children.
Here they stand, hand in hand, and exchange wedding bands.
Archbishop John Myers of Newark says marriage in the US is threatened and undermined in many ways. His warning came as he released a pastoral letter on marriage this week, which looks at the definition, purpose and sanctity of marriage. As head of one of the nation's largest dioceses, with well over 1 million Catholics, Archbishop Myers makes the case for traditional marriage between a man and a woman, according to the natural law. So, what prompted him to write this pastoral letter right now? And why is the state of marriage navigating in such rocky waters? Archbishop Myers tells us more.
Well, I have been planning it for some months because the state of marriage in the United States is alarming, both because people are not marrying or because they divorce and remarry, and which affects their relationship with the church. And in general, it's an undermining of family life and the basis of solid society here in the United States. So I'm concerned both for faith reasons and as a citizen of the United States about the welfare of our own culture.
Now, you talked there about culture, and many would say that, of course, cultural pressures have a lot to do with why the state of marriage is so threatened today, particularly when we look at our celebrity culture. We see, you know, the stars who go from marriage to another marriage, a partner to another partner. It doesn't send a good role model, does it, to society at large?
It is not. I believe that those who are celebrities reflect culture in general and also help form it. But perhaps because they are so much the center of attention and of their own world, they come to think of their own world as the world. Beyond that, the broader tendency in our society is to have, there is no openness to transcendent, no openness to God, and the world is a gift of God that we are privileged and gifted to live in, but according to God's way, not our own way. People think that their own personal feelings, current intuitions, current preferences are really sufficient basis for making moral decision, and of course it is not, and it's led to the chaos which we have now.
There's also the fact that those who try to defend traditional marriage are often accused of being old-fashioned or bigoted. Do you find that this is something that many people are concerned about within the church?
Well, I certainly tried to raise that issue in my pastoral, and of course we are concerned about it. We see what could happen if we look at a nation like Canada, where even ministers of religions who preach the faith which they believe and the understanding of marriage which they have within their own faith, some of them have been formally charged with hate speech, speaking out of hatred, which of course is not true when you are simply speaking the truth. So that is, I think, a major concern thrown in with the fact that our young people, we have two generations of poor catechesis, and they've experienced an instability in their families, very often divorce and remarriage. People don't bother to marry. There are all kinds of reasons why a marriage seems to be threatened, and yet a good, solid marriage, according to the understanding of God and the way God made it, is really a foundation of society. So, yes, we are concerned about that, but the concern continues if the state starts to continues to intervene. What do we do in our schools or our public programs for youth when they teach or are required to teach that marriage of two people with homosexual orientation is an acceptable and one of the standard ways of understanding marriage? And my point is that in no way that can that be called marriage. Whatever it be called, it is not marriage according to the centuries of tradition, according to the understanding of not only the Catholic Church, but other churches and Muslims and Jews and Mormons and all kinds of other faiths do not find that an acceptable way of approaching marriage.
So do you think that the threats against marriage are increasing?
Yes, I do, I'm sorry to say, because the polls show that even Catholics, some Catholics anyway, do not see a problem with same-sex, I hate to call it marriage, but same-sex unions. And so they're more tolerant and even supportive of this approach, which is fraught with danger for society in addition to being morally wrong.
So what remedies do you propose that the church should carry out to try and counter, as you say, this prevailing culture that threatens and undermines marriage?
Well, I think we have to redouble our efforts, preaching and teaching, and we need to be, as the Holy Fathers have called us, to not be afraid to take our understanding of the truth and the truth of the gospel into the public forum. And the public forum will mean speaking up. It will mean helping our neighbors and friends and families to understand what the real issues are and the dangers that are contained in this approach. And I think we just have to be more effective teachers. And that's, of course, what I'm trying to be part of that effort among the bishops on this issue at this time.
And you put forward any other suggestions in your pastoral letter?
Well, I said that part of our responsibility when we moved to the public forum, contacting legislatures and people who help form public policy, and not only speaking up and contacting them, but then to take that into account seriously when we're in the voting booth.
I was speaking to Archbishop John Myers of Newark.
God bless this couple who marry today.
If you have an Android smartphone, then visit our website and download Vatican Radio's first app. It's free. The application contains an agenda that lets you access text and audio content associated with the Pope's public events, while informing you in real time about papal celebrations broadcast live. A news service provides the latest information on the Church and the world, while a radio section links you to Vatican Radio's 5 audio channels and its 40 different language services. Audio, video, text, news, editorials, live broadcasts, all in a single app. Go to our website at www.radiovaticana.va and click on the icon in the upper right-hand corner. The version for iPhone and iPad is coming soon.
Well, that's all for today, but we'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow, and you can always find our programs on the internet at www.radiovaticana.va. Laudato Jesus Christus.